Hi, my name's Mike Nagrant, and you're listening to Hungry Magazine from Chicago, Illinois.
4, 3, 2, 1
more time.
Hey there, welcome back for another edition of the Hungry Magazine podcast. You know, this week I sit down with Bruce Sherman at North Pond Restaurant here in Chicago. But before we get into that interview, you might have heard the Chicago City Council banned the sale of foie gras. Now, I'm not getting into a big debate on the podcast, but if you do want to hear a bit more, a group of us over at the Culinary Podcast Network, www.culinarypodcastnetwork, recently conducted a roundtable free-for-all in the debate, and, you know, we had a lot of fun with it. So I think you'll enjoy it, so check that out. You know, last night I did go over to Avenue's Restaurant in the Peninsula Hotel to celebrate the end of the foie gras era here in Chicago. And I had Chef Graham Elliott Bull's 12-course foie menu. You know, I had foie juice, foie dust, foie terrine, foie torchon, seared foie, and yes, a foie milkshake for dessert. Hey, you know, if this was the 1920s and Prohibition was about to take effect and I celebrated this way, I'd probably be in jail right now. So, you know, thanks to the kitchen staff over at Avenues, Chefs Carrie, Alex, Marianne, Elena, and Chef Bowles for that incredible meal. You know, as they say, everything tastes better with bacon. And, you know, now I can say, indeed, everything tastes better with foie gras. And finally, one last note on the subject of foie. You know, I had a chance to speak with Alderman Joe Moore yesterday, the alderman who actually sponsored the ban. And, you know, when I asked him whether he'd ever had foie gras, he said, and this is a direct quote starting now, "I may have. I didn't know what I was eating, but I was told by a friend of mine that that dined with me at one of our trendy restaurants a while back." You know, this is before the controversy blew up last year. "That it may have been part of an appetizer that may have been served to us. But I honestly can't remember it, and I don't remember what it tasted like." Yeah, Joe. Hey, I'm sure Bill Clinton didn't inhale either. Listen, I know Alderman Moore had foie gras, and trust me, you don't forget the taste. But no matter where you stand on this issue, the lesson here is that our politicians need to be more responsible about the legislation they sponsor. A lot more of Alderman Moore's constituents are going to be heard if a factory farm chicken contracts a flu virus.
You're listening to Hungry Magazine on the Culinary Podcast Network. Mike has an insatiable appetite for food news.
Indeed, you are listening to the Culinary Podcast Network, as I mentioned before, and in fact, if you hadn't had a chance to do so, please stop over there. You know, it really is a one-stop shop of all the best food podcasts on the web. If you like what you've been listening to here, you'll love Mark Tafoya and Jennifer Yanola in New York City and Steve Wasser in Los Angeles, and of course, local culinary Chicago instructor Tom Beckman's pastry lessons. Finally, before we get into this week's interview with Chef Bruce Sherman at North Pond, the folks over at Julius Meinl Coffee House here in Chicago have donated some of their coffee, teas, and fruit preserves for our Hungry Magazine listeners. So over the next 2 weeks, please sign up for our email list at www.hungrymag.com to be entered for a chance to win some great Meinl coffee. If you already signed up for the mailing list, you are eligible for this giveaway. I'll announce the winner 2 weeks from now. On to this week's interview. Bruce Sherman is the executive chef over at Chicago's North Pond Restaurant. Chef Sherman was named Food & Wine Best New Chef in 2003. And most importantly, he's probably one of the most politically conscious and seasonally focused chefs in the city. He's been instrumental in helping grow Chicago's Green City Market. He's a member of the Chefs Collaborative, an organization that teaches chefs about sustainability issues. And he's a big supporter of local family farms. Chef Sherman is also a graduate of Penn, the London School of Economics, and spent some time living abroad in India, where he learned to cook seasonally based on what was available at the local produce vendor or Walla.
Not to be sensationalistic, but I think that the, you know, one of the things that in looking at your background, I know that you're really involved, certainly with a lot of food consciousness, you know, in terms of the Green City Market, mm-hmm. You know, the Chefs Collaborative, and a lot of the organizations. I know you teach about sustainability at your children's elementary school, and, mm-hmm. Of course, the big thing on the map right now is the foie gras issue, the foie gras uh-huh. ban. I know, you know, that's something you served at your restaurant. Uh-huh. You know, and I'm curious about your decision to do that. And, you know, in light of some of the arguments that are out there, I know certainly, unless they're going to legislate vegetarianism, it's a tough call. You know, meat in general is not produced the best way. I know that you look for the best ways that things are produced.
Right.
But I'm curious about your decision to serve it and what you think about the ban.
It's always been a difficult one for me. It's been one of the issues, topics, proteins that has always been on the horizon for the next move. I've, ironically enough, had it on my menu ever since I've been here, you know, over 6 years. And the more involved I get with sustainability issues and and farmers and humane treatment, the more I sort of intellectually struggle with the choice to put it on. And I guess that's my classically trained, traditional French side that says, hey, I'm a French cook. Foie gras is one of those luxury ingredients. The traditional argument, of course, is, well, these guys who legislate, who A, have probably never even eaten foie gras, and B, don't know what it is and don't understand where it's coming from, certainly haven't thought about the industrial factory pork and beef and chicken that I'm sure they eat on a regular basis, which is much less humanely treated than foie. I'm certainly not going to argue for the humane treatment of the ducks that create the foie or produce the foie. But at the same time, you know, there's a hierarchy of what's worse, and maybe we should legislate or consider legislation of things that might be more serious, and then get around to the things lower on the scale. So, have I been affected by it? A little bit. I think in a certain sense it's made it a little easier for me, because I'm going to have to take it off the menu. We've sold a hell of a lot of foie gras in the last 2 weeks, and I imagine that'll continue until it's sort of day of reckoning.
Yeah, I think the irony is that you know, everything I've read has said that foie gras sales have gone up.
Yeah, tremendously. Probably, I don't know, I'd say 20-25%.
Wow.
Over the last couple of weeks. I guess I shake my head at both the self-importance of the alderman and the fact that in the relative scheme of things, there are other things that are more important than foie.
The same legislators should be focusing more on how we get more family farms, how we get more local produce in this area. And
I think so. Support the local people first, and then think about the producers who are out of the region or other bigger issues, if you truly want to be local about it.
I'm interested in your background in the sense of, you know, I know you went to the, you, I think you had said at one time that you were sort of groomed to be a lawyer. You went to the London School of Economics in Penn. And, you know, I think you said in college, I think it was in the Food and Wine article, you said you figured out that you could do whatever you wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious if there was a moment there, or, you know, what it was that kind of opened your eyes. I mean, did you always know you wanted to be a chef, or you wanted to cook, or was there an experience?
I don't think there was a seminal moment that I could point to and say, this is when it occurred. I think it was probably at the LSE or shortly after returning from the LSE that economics for me became way too abstract and bullshit econometrics, formulaic. The thing that always attracted me to economics was the real life application of the work. To talk about, I think, you know, freshman year, I had this fabulous radical professor who had taught at Berkeley and was at Penn, had moved to Penn, and that one of the textbooks for Econ 1A was a book detailing real life markets and how economics applied to them. And we did case studies about, I think, the baseball strike and about the legalization of marijuana and how we put that into an economic framework. And that really got me hooked, because I was able to, I don't know, codify and understand how this science applied to real life. And then as it became more involved, it became less about the real world and more about textbooks and numbers and things. And maybe the transition started at that stage as it became less about the real world. And then I started to think about, God, what was I going to do after I got out of school? And realized that I could do whatever I wanted to do instead of go get another degree and push numbers around or talk about, you know, law. Did I know I always wanted to cook? No, but I think 90% of the people who are successful cooking wouldn't be successful doing much else, or they wouldn't be successful at it or satisfied at it very long. I really think that we're genetically predisposed to get to food somehow, whether it's in restaurants or in retail or in production. It's always going to come back. You have it and you can't shake it.
Mm-hmm.
You can't change your genes.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting too, though. You know, the folks who are successful at it and the folks who are, you know, doing some of the most interesting work weren't culinary school trained. I mean, you know, you look at a guy like Paul Kahn, who, you know, has applied mathematics at Northern Illinois, or, you know, Charlie Trotter, I know, was poli-sci at Wisconsin. Or, you know, I think, you know, as I talk to more and more chefs, I think one of the things I notice is that it's kind of this effect of, you know, you would have been good at anything you did. You know, you're mm-hmm. a bright person, and mm-hmm. it's just applying that knowledge and applying that focus on something that you really are passionate about. You know, I guess I don't think enough people do that. Yeah, and it's tough for people to take that step. That's why I'm just curious, you know, how you came to that realization. Some people never come to that realization.
I think I finally put the pieces together when every job that I was attracted to had something to do with food.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you think about it, and like I said, put the pieces together, it makes sense that you're going in one direction. How do you harness that? How do you focus? What is it you're looking for? I think that whether it's Paul or whether it's anybody else, it's about having the scientific makeup that you're going to do it. Like you said, you can do anything. It's the 95% perspiration thing and not the 5% inspiration. And yeah, most of us work our asses off. It's difficult to understand people who don't have that drive.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably one of the most difficult parts about the job.
Yeah.
Is trying to inspire people or have people get it that don't have the genetic makeup.
Yeah, it's the idea that you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. I think I read The Soul of a Chef, uh-huh. Michael Roman's book. And
uh-huh.
I remember reading about how he was talking about Grant Achatz and Eric Zibel, the French laundry, and how these guys, you know, if they were working for Thomas Keller, they were working for somebody else, it didn't matter because it was within them or it was like an internal thing.
Uh-huh.
That, you know, Thomas didn't have to go and inspire them to do it, you know.
Right.
It's almost like that's the sign of a good chef is, you know, you can only get so much from a mentorship or you can only get so much from somebody who's teaching you what to do, but you have to have it within yourself.
Absolutely. It's all about that mirror. It's not going to come. You could work at the best places, but you toss two people into the same kitchen, the same chef, and you're going to get two different products, the guy or the woman who's inspired and is just self-driven and has the initiative and the ambition is going to make wonderful things come out of that experience for their lifetime. The person who went to cooking school but doesn't necessarily understand what it's about could be in that kitchen, but they're going to just come out with time spent in the kitchen, something on their resume. Yeah, it's all about the individual.
So I know you had a catering operation
mm-hmm.
that you were part of before you moved to India.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like? Was that a completely different experience than obviously what you're doing here? Did you apply the same principles of craft? Can you do that in a catering operation?
Yeah, you can, but I wouldn't say that my catering company was that way. For me, it was more about, I suppose, having a small business, being in a small entrepreneur with food again. It wasn't nearly at this level. It was catering to a sort of business clientele. The notion was going Monday to Friday, business hours, to deal with business meetings and other events around the corporate boardroom. And that, as I'm sure you understand, is hardly fine dining. You know, steak and potatoes on a good day.
Sure.
So as creative as you might want to be, it's not what the market's looking for.
So I'd like to hear a little bit about your time in India. I know you've talked about how that time was sort of an opportunity where you cook seasonally because, frankly, you had to. I think you were in a place where what the market had. And I'd like to hear a little bit about that experience for you and how that's shaped what you're doing today. Obviously, the seasonal aspect, but
I think it's absolutely that. You know, necessity is the mother of invention. It's about not having a choice every day. I was fortunate enough to live there 3.5 years. And, you know, 3.5 weeks or 3.5 days in India is enough to make an indelible impression with anybody. So imagine 3.5 years there. The things you see on a day-to-day basis, whether it's cows lying in the middle of the road or whether it's people lying in the middle of the road, dead or alive, it's something that you have to think about and process, whether it's when you're there seeing it or whether it's later when you're downloading and figuring out what you've seen. In terms of the profound effect it's had on my cooking, it absolutely shaped my notion of what seasonality is about. It was at a time, and even that has changed now in India, when there wasn't all this product available all the time anywhere, where I would need to go to the vegetable wallah's tent every day to consider what my options were for dinner. And the options were limited as to what could come from Uttar Pradesh or from the outskirts of Delhi or from the east or from the west. And it depended on the time of year. It also depended on what might be safe to eat and what might not be. At that time, you know, leafy greens were not a good choice because of the pesticides and whatever night soil was on them. So it forced me to think about and learn different ways of thinking and different techniques and different combinations, and absolutely shaped how I think about it today. And then that was reinforced by time later in France and Europe, where that's just a way of life for Europeans to understand it that way. But going back to India, you know, not only in the markets, but dealing with villagers who didn't understand the most fundamental rules about things so basic as sanitation or cross-contamination or how to boil an egg, and starting at a very basic level to teach some kids, villagers, how to cook had an effect. And to this day, you know, it affects how I think about what I do and what we're doing relative to what's out there beyond these skyscrapers. And what's, you know, on a, I guess what's important, what's really important, and what's more important, again, going back to this hierarchy.
Yeah, I mean, perspective and patience, you know, are two things you probably learn from an experience like that, I would guess. And speaking of which, I think, not to return to the Food and Wine article, but I think I also read about you had the Bernard Loiseau book on your, mm-hmm. you were reading that at the time. You know, and again, there's a thing where, you know, here's somebody who died as a result of their perspective, maybe, you know. Mm-hmm. How did that impact you? I know you said you were profoundly impacted, but...
By Loiseau's death?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was, I wouldn't say a mentor, I never worked for him, but I certainly regarded him very highly because of his appreciation for sort of the fundamental product and highlighting through his craft what was pure and what tasted good. So his death was... I had read Burgundy Stars, I don't know, 5 years prior to that, perhaps. And then all of a sudden, he was gone. I wouldn't say it, you know, shocked me on a daily level, but there's always something, you know, whether it's today or tomorrow, that it's going to bring us back to trying to put things in perspective, like you said. And Loiseau's death just makes one think about what it is we do and how seriously we should take it. And yeah, we take it very seriously, but it shouldn't be about life and death. If we take it that seriously, something's wrong. I think.
Did you, were you, was your perspective different before that? Did you take it more seriously?
I don't think it was a shock to me. I mean, not in the sense of being a shock, but I don't think it changed my perspective. It just confirmed, reinforced, exemplified what it was all about or should be about. It's obviously it's a tragic story.
Yeah.
That it had such a dramatic effect. I mean, Loiseau was a unique guy, and there weren't many chefs who were as crazy as he was.
Yeah.
But the pressure there to perform and compete on that level is pretty intense. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in certain ways it's not that different here if you take it that way. You know, whether it's opening a new restaurant or dealing with something so simple as a menu change or the arrival or lack of arrival of a product that we were expecting. It's our nature. We tend to be, as cooks, as chefs, we tend to be in a certain way obsessive compulsive about product, and you know, it comes with passion, it comes with intensity, whether it's about the ramps not arriving, or whether it's about a restaurant and the chairs not arriving, or the health inspectors not arriving. It's pretty serious stuff. It helps for me to have a wife and two beautiful girls to ground me, so that when I'm really stressed out about stuff and I get home and I've got the two kids there and my wife, you know, there are other things that are more important.
Since we're talking about that, one of the things, as I mentioned earlier, I know that you do teach about issues of sustainability at your kids' school. One of the things I'm really interested in, or one of the things I've been talking a lot about lately in my interviews, is this idea of, you know, how do you inspire the next generation? You know, I mean, as a society, we're getting farther and farther away from our food and farther away from the idea of what that means. You know, and I'm curious about, especially with younger children, you know, how do you approach that? What's the best way? How do they understand that? You know, I know that children are very smart people, and you know, I don't want to underestimate that fact, but there's a perspective, or there's probably a way of doing it, and I'm curious how you approach that.
I think it's really important to educate kids about food and where it comes from and what it means. And I do that in an effort to program them to get some information on their hard drive for later in their life. I do it by bringing in beautiful seasonal food, showing them, letting them smell it, preparing it in a way where they can taste it, and teaching them about issues relating to it on a elemental level. I'm not expecting that they're going to retain it, you know, that they're going to retain 99% of it. I'm looking for the nugget, I'm looking for the kernel, I'm looking for the 1% that they're going to remember short term when they go to the grocery store with their parents. And I'm looking for payback 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now when something clicks on their internal memory that brings them back to that. So, last week I brought in a 20-pound halibut and a 12-pound wild salmon to my daughter's class and broke it down in front of them. We talked about issues regarding the health of the seafood stocks and the management of it. And there's nothing that makes as much an impact with a kid as seeing this gigantic fish. What do they see if they're lucky enough to eat fish? They're seeing a nameless, faceless fillet,
right,
that their mom or dad brings home from the grocery store. Well, here I am with a big fish, and we talked about round fish and flat fish, and I get, again, most of it's going to go over their head. I understand that, but it's just a small piece that I need them to think about or incorporate or understand. That's going to have an impact. And to have these kids have a piece of halibut. I made halibut for them. We broke it down. We cooked it, and I brought in a carrot reduction and a citrus snap pea puree and put that on the plate with this little piece of halibut. Initially, the kids shy away from anything that's green or any kind of fresh fish, but because of because of the performance, I suppose, they're more inclined to try it. And I think because they're out of their home environment where their parents aren't cooking for them, they're more inclined to try something. And certainly, I don't know, I would say 80% of them said, wow, this is really good. I'm going to ask my parents to get halibut. Or I want to have this at home. And that's all it takes.
That's great.
Yeah. So I think that has more of a dramatic effect on them later. My fear with them is that the inspiration's not going to get to obsession, in the sense that I don't want to inspire them, quote unquote, so much that they want to go watch food TV and, God forbid, become a chef. It's the last thing I'm looking for.
You don't want them to become a chef in general, or you don't want them to become a food network TV driven chef? Or
I'd say both. I think they both have serious implications.
So you wouldn't want your kids to
I wouldn't
be
want
chefs.
My kid to be chefs or cooks. It's a horrible life. Yeah, I couldn't do anything else, and I wouldn't necessarily choose to do anything else. But look at what we do to ourselves. Between the type of work we've chosen, the hours we have to work, the lack of monetary compensation for doing it, the danger of what we work and what we do. Horrible. You know, how can you easily have a normal life or a family doing what we do? Yeah, I do it because I love it, and I couldn't do anything else because of what we talked about earlier. But I wouldn't want my kids to do that.
A lot of those pressures, I mean, are those a function of the economics of the margins of food? Everybody's, you know, keeping their entrees near $30 or whatever, you know, and really should they be $40? I mean, there's this sense of, you know, differentiation in the marketplace. Like, how do you get people to pay for quality? I mean, somebody, you know, a lot of people don't understand the difference between a small producer and you know, what they're getting from, you know, big aggregate. And so they're not willing to pay for it. You know, or is it just a function of perfectionism and a function of, you know, you want to be in the kitchen at all times because you're, you know, you, like you said, there's this obsessive compulsive nature.
I think it's a little bit of all of that. I think it's the marketplace in terms of what you can put on a plate, what you can charge for. Certainly more so here in Chicago than any other place in the U.S. The Midwesterners are value conscious. And if you're going to charge $32-$35 for something, you got to deliver in terms of what perceived value is, not in the sense of what it costs. No one understands how expensive a morel or a truffle is in the way that we do. But people like and understand and appreciate the Cheesecake Factory valuation of food. So we have to do it in a context that's economic, but at the same time, we have to be careful about the product we're putting on the plate. You know, I could easily fill up a plate with industrial product, but I choose to use small farm product, crafted stuff, and it costs more. And I'm almost stuck between a rock and a hard place trying to make money using expensive product, but that's what we choose to do. But I'm not so sure that it's that much different at any other, you know, independent fine dining restaurant, whether it's French or Italian or Moroccan or Spanish, whatever. It's still, the margins of our business are so small and thin and tenuous that unless you choose to go volume, you're not going to make a ton of money.
It's interesting that the marketplace is developed that way, that people continue to keep the prices fixed like that. But, you know, it's by doing that, we've changed consumers' expectations. You know, they expect it to be always $30 for that entree or whatever. And, you know, if it goes to $40, they're like, they'll walk away, you know, or they'll go to TGI Fridays or whatever it is.
I think it'll change, especially so if the fuel prices don't come down, because we're all getting imposed with supplements from all of our purveyors. Naturally, it costs them more to bring stuff in. And eventually, we're going to have to get to the point where we have to pass it on. Because our margins are so low, we can't absorb it all the time. And people are, like you said, they're either going to accept that because they're paying more, or they're going to reject it, go somewhere else, and that's when the economy goes into the dumper and we go into recession. Or inflation gets so great that we have other troubles. But eventually something's got to change.
how important is the ambiance to you as a chef? I mean, you have probably one of the most beautiful restaurants in Chicago in terms of, you know, it's a very pastoral setting here in Lincoln Park. And, you know, I know one of the things that's always criticized with the Michelin, you know, system is that, you know, they're using the Christoffel china and, the, you know, the beautiful, you know, and that adds to the price. I know as somebody who loves food, just, you know, when I first went to Paris and I was looking at those prices, even for me, it was like, oh, wow. You know, it's like, you know, I can go to Trotter's for, you know, only $140 a person, you know.
That's right.
You know, does that play a role? You know, I there's, you know, of course, there's the big gastropub movement in England and the brasseries and France and, you know, that almost seems in some ways like a midpoint here. You know, I know, you know, people are starting to think about that. Paul Kahn's thinking about opening up a gastro pub. And so you're not investing as much in the overhead there. And, you know, you're focusing more on comfort food prepared well from good producers still. You know, it seems like that leaves an opportunity to maybe make some money and you know, still introduce people to good food. But you don't have it as high cost for the ambiance or the, you know, but I understand there's a place for it, but
I think it's very tempting. There's a great place for that, for just good food, where people can go have a finely crafted beer and great food that complements it, or vice versa. It would be nice to do simpler food using quality ingredients in a more straightforward setting. The difficulty is the primary product, the inputs, cost too much on a certain scale to be able to use them at a super low, almost affordable level. And so it's in a certain way counterintuitive to do something so simple that you can charge, or you have to charge so much for. People want to go simple. They want it. Simple implies cheap, I suppose. Again, coming back to this notion, consciousness here in Chicago of what something should cost, or what becomes extravagant, and that's a difficult thing. Using small farm product costs more. The price is going to come down as more people get into the marketplace, but the small farm stuff is never going to be cheap. It's the big growers who are getting in and driving the cost down, which is good for everybody. But if you still want to work with the small farms, it's not going to come down significantly.
Sure, and you know they may only have three or four goats producing whatever milk they need, and so you can't reach those volumes with that one small producer. It's just impossible.
But yeah, I would love to consider do a small restaurant where it's more straightforward, honest food. The other difficulty is you got to find a space where you can afford to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
And the places, it's all about, naturally it's about location, location, location. The places where you have the best location are not going to be the cheapest, where you can afford to do the straightforward plate. You got to make the money somewhere.
Yeah, you almost have to take a chance on it being a destination.
Precisely.
You know, like Jerry Kleiner's done, or you know, something like that. And there's no guarantee there.
Yeah. Right. Or you do it on such a small scale that you build up.
Yeah.
And you expand that way, you build into your business plan.
So I read a little bit about, I guess one of your mentors was Gabriel Bousquet. I'm curious about that. You know, that's not a name I think a lot of people know. And, you know, I'm curious about that relationship and what you learned and what that was like.
Gabriel, he was a chef, mentor, friend from Paris, from school, who refined everything that I had been doing up till then. For me, culinary school was sort of a graduate school, finishing school, because of my less traditional path. He was able to, for me, to rip things apart and rebuild it, or show me the way to rebuild it properly, or to take what I had and to refine it, polish it so that it was right, I suppose, and true, and conform to, I don't know, the European tradition, standard craft. And I was able to work quite closely with him because of, I suppose, where I was in life, in the sense that I was coming from experience before I got there and knew exactly why I was there and what I wanted to do. He appreciated that because he wasn't used to people in my position, I suppose. He was used to more sort of green kids who didn't know what they were doing. And he took it as an opportunity to do what he wanted to do or I wanted to do. And, you know, Gabriel and I are close to this day. I try and go back to Paris every year, and I see him all the time and correspond with him. He had worked old school. He had been the senior, I think he was chef de cuisine at Maxime's way back when Maxime's was something, and had all that old school experience, technique, craft. That's hard to find these days.
Yeah. I mean, I know as somebody who's a home cook, you know, the one thing and missing is, like, you know, you don't know if you're doing it right, you know, and you can rely on your senses and say it tastes right, but you know, you can't really figure out texture, or, you know, it seems like it might be, but you don't know, you know, because you don't have that reference point.
Right, precisely. I think what a lot of people don't do at home when they're trying to experiment or teach themselves is appreciate the fact that it's about enjoying it at home. If you're stressing out and you're freaking out, then step away.
Yeah.
It's not supposed to be like that at home.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be enjoyable, and, you know, treat it as a learning opportunity, and to try different textures and flavors and heats. Get stressed out when it's work, and that's why we tell people, if you want to enjoy cooking all the time, you know, continue to cook at home. But it's not a place for hobbyists.
Sure.
To come to the kitchen, it's hard work.
Now that you're in the position that you are, you know, with a successful restaurant and being a successful chef, what do you and Gabrielle speak about now? I mean, what kind of perspective do you look for, or you guys talk about?
We talk about whether it's recipes, what people are trying, what people are experimenting with. Kids today, you know, unemployment in France and how crazy the government is. It runs the gamut. It's not just food anymore. It's about everything.
It's about life.
His daughters. What I can expect later. Yeah.
I was just looking at one of your recent menus, and one of the things I came across that I was curious about, I thought was interesting, is you had a ginger Hefeweizen sauce on one of your... And the other thing I thought was interesting was the wild rambouillon. And I thought those were, I don't know, they just, for some reason, I don't even know if there's a comment there, but it's just, they stuck out to me as being kind of interesting or something you don't see.
I mean, the challenge about cooking seasonally, again, is making it inventive enough and contemporary enough that it's interesting. So you look at a menu and you're taken by a couple of things that are either unconventional or things that sound interesting to you. For us, it's about not doing the same thing every year with the ramps. Or looking for something different that is new and interesting and complementary to the products we're using. The ramp broth, we're infusing a chickpea broth with ramps that we're getting, the beautiful ramps we're getting this time of year, to give it that wonderfully oniony, garlicky flavor with that sort of legume finish. The Hefeweizen ginger reduction we're pairing with sort of a pork poo-poo platter. We're using it with a suckling pig that we go 16 hours with and wrap in pig skin. It's kind of like a pork burrito, I suppose. And then we do it with a belly that's cured over 72 hours, and then again slow roasted and braised. And then a cold smoke grilled quail. And we pair, you know, we're looking to pair different flavors together, as is our job, I suppose. Again, trying to run the balance between something that's nutty, crazy, no one's ever done before, and something that's so conventional you're going to find it in a brasserie or a bistro. What we do here is trying to be interesting, inventive, but not so wacky.
I was surprised to read about your experience in India, because it doesn't seem, those influences don't seem to show up too much in your menu. Like, you're not cooking with cardamom, or is that a conscious choice?
No, it's not conscious at all. I think for anyone who would think about it, it's unusual. You would expect me to be doing the tabla thing, where it's French technique with Asian ingredients. and it's not my style to do that. Yeah, I have curries. I have some influence of curry, not curry, but Indian food on my menus from time to time. Last menu I had a carrot ginger curry on a lobster dish. Or I do a cashew thing. It creeps in there. But for me, like I said, the most dramatic effect of my time there was on product and seasonality. Indian food, it's not that permanent for me in terms of my interest or my attraction to it. It's something from time to time I'll do something, but it's only time to time.
You know, we talked a little bit about how tough of a job it is and how many hours you work, and you know, you do have two children and your wife. And do you have any sense of this is a pace you want to keep up for a while, or do you have an idea of where you want to go from here? And, you know, are you just happy with what's going on?
I don't think I can, in terms of the whole sustainability issues. You know, for me personally, I don't think I can. I can't keep it up in a way where I'd be able to keep everybody happy, whether it's me or whether it's my wife or whether my two kids. And in the continuum of what's important, you know, I need to spend time with these kids before they can. They don't want to spend any time with me, as adolescents do, whether it's me or somebody else.
Sure.
So now's the time to make the time to spend with them. So no, I can't really keep it up. I don't really want to keep it up. You know, we get older, whether you're talking about Paul or Sean or I.
Sure.
And the bodies just, they don't cooperate. My body's not falling apart in any sense, but it's not going to last if we keep up these hours all the time. So it's trying to figure out some sustainable process to make it happen. Again, it goes sort of counter to what we are as cooks and as chefs, to want to be involved in all this stuff. To try and say, okay, well, I want to be involved, but I don't want to be involved because I have to be with the family, and I need to spend less time. I haven't figured out how to do it yet. I'm working on that now.
Yeah, I remember reading about Thomas Keller talking about one of the reasons, you know, he opened Per Se was that, you know what, he's in his mid-40s, and you know what, his knees, when he goes down to clean out a cooler or something, it's like, it's just painful.
Yeah.
You know, or even, I was talking to Doug Sohn at Hot Dogs, and he was saying, you know, he's like, he was, at the time, I think he was like, you know, I'm like in my early 40s with like 60-year-old knees, you know.
Right.
And, it's
yeah, it's really hard.
It's a tough proposition.
It's a physical profession.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's getting down isn't so hard, it's getting up again. Absolutely.
If you know, say you were throwing a dinner at North Pond, or you're throwing a dinner party at home, and you could invite anybody living or dead, who would you want there? And, you know, even if it's only a couple key people, you know, why? You know, what would you ask them? What would you want to talk to them about?
My wife and kids would be there. But I think number one on the list would be my mother. She died 20 plus years ago. And never saw anything that I'm doing now, or anything. I mean, I was still in my 20s trying to figure out what the hell I was going to do with my life when she died. So I would certainly want her there. And I would ask her, you know, why have you created this? Who else would I want there? I don't know. I would want good friends of ours. I think for me, food is about sharing. It's about socializing. I don't know that I would say I would want to have world figures, world leaders, to get into their brain about what they do or why they did it. Sure, I would love to have Gabrielle, I suppose, be part of the meal, but others would be good friends who understand what we're about and what we do here, to talk about that. I mean, I've been fortunate enough to have, you know, important people come to the restaurant. Julia Child's been here. Alice Waters has been here. I don't tend to get the Hollywood flavor of the days here at the restaurant because of the nature of where we are and what we do. So some of the series, those people would be important to me, but they've been here, and I, you know, have contact, so I feel lucky that way.
Yeah. Did you get to talk to Julia Child?
I did. She, how long ago was this? It was probably 5 years ago. She was in town for an IACP event at the Ritz, and she came over here on Sunday night with a group of, I think, 6 or 8. She was getting on at the time.
Yeah.
I talked to her briefly. It was just an honor to have her in the restaurant.
At the level that you were at, was it still intimidating at all to cook for that group, or no?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think at that time, anyone of that renown coming into the restaurant was a serious undertaking. Nowadays, you know, I'm more comfortable with what I do. I know what I do, and we just, I don't want to say take it or leave it, but I, you know, it's what I do. So it was nerve-wracking in a certain sense, especially so since I had brunch with her the previous day, and she was deconstructing and evaluating the meal she had at the Ritz the night before, talking about how flavorless something was she had at the meal, and she couldn't understand. I think she was talking about heirloom tomatoes. There was an heirloom tomato dish, an heirloom tomato consomme, I think it was, and she couldn't understand what the big deal was about these tomatoes. They were flavorless. Thinking, oh, it's great, she's coming into my restaurant tomorrow night.
They weren't real heirloom tomatoes.
They weren't on the menu. She loves oysters. She had oysters, and I don't know, she had blueberry tart. I don't remember. I think she had duck.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have the menu inside, so.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Say you knew the meal you were going to eat in a particular day was your last meal. What do you think you would eat or choose to have?
My last meal?
Yeah.
I would probably have a greasy cheeseburger, French fries maybe, or cassoulet and a frisée salad with a poached egg on it.
Do you have a quintessential cheeseburger in mind?
A place that's not there anymore, a place called Big Al's that had like two greasy, it's like a double cheeseburger on the flat top griddle, greasy melted cheese on top of it, and sort of limpid, flaccid hot French fries in one of those plastic baskets with the tissue paper in it, with everything on it. Sloppy, you know, used to go there as a kid after Saturday morning basketball.
Where was this?
This was up in Glencoe. Play Saturday morning basketball and in the middle of winter, come out of the showers and out where your hair freezes, and then walk over to Big Al's and have a greasy double cheeseburger with the fries.
Yeah,
that was good stuff.
Sounds great.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Sure, thank you.
Hey, thanks again for listening this week. You know, next week we'll be exploring coffee. I speak with Thomas Meinl, the fourth generation in the Julius Meinl coffee roasting family, as well as Doug Zell from Intelligentsia Coffee here in Chicago. As always, please send your feedback to mjnagran@hungrymag.com. Now finally, in the words of TV chefs Rachel Ray, Emeril Lagasse, and Wolfgang Puck, bam, yummo, and live, love, and eat. Oh wait, maybe I should have my own original cute sign-off. Right, Seacrest out.